Welcome to Teleforum, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President, General Counsel, and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. For exclusive access to live recordings of practice group Teleforum calls, become a Federalist Society member today at fedsoc.org.
Welcome to the Federalist Society's Teleforum conference call. This afternoon, October 23rd, 2020, we're discussing Catholic judges and the death penalty. I'm Nick Marr. I'm Assistant Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. As always, please note that expressions of opinion on today's call are those of our expert. And I'd like to note they're also his personal views, not the view of his law firm. We're fortunate to have with us today Ryan Proctor. He's an associate at Jones Day. So after Ryan gives his opening remarks, should go about a half hour, we'll then go to audience question and answer. So be thinking of those when we get to that portion of the call. Thanks for sharing with us today, Ryan. I'll give the floor over to you.
Thank you so much, and thank you to the Federalist Society for hosting this event. So I said our topic today is whether Catholic judges who are faithful to church teaching can, in good conscience, participate in capital cases. Now, to be clear, this is not an issue of how to interpret the law. I'm taking for granted that the death penalty is constitutional and that the law requires judges in some circumstances to issue or affirm death sentences. Instead, it's an issue of whether it's morally permissible under church teaching to carry out what the law commands. Now, obviously, I'm coming at this from a Catholic perspective, but I do think this topic is worthwhile for others because, first, Catholics aren't the only people with religious and moral concerns about the death penalty. And second, most people, I think, agree that there can be a point where the law commands something that, in good conscience, we cannot follow, that a point where just following orders isn't a good enough reason to do something. Now, the answer to this question of whether Catholics can participate in capital cases is surprisingly not straightforward, because this area of church teaching is complicated. It encompasses two main questions. First, whether and to what extent the death penalty is morally wrong under church teaching. And second, what consequences follow for a judge if the death penalty is morally wrong? Now, sincere, faithful Catholics in the legal profession who are knowledgeable about their faith and knowledgeable about the law have wrestled with these two questions and reached a wide range of conclusions. So, for instance, Justice Scalia, in a 2002 article in First Things called God's Justice and Ours, concluded that the death penalty is morally permissible. And so Catholic judges can fully participate in capital cases. Judge Amy Barrett, when she was fresh out of law school in 1998 in the Markell Law Review, in an article called Catholic Judges in Capital Cases, concluded that the death penalty is morally wrong, at least in modern circumstances. And so Catholic judges cannot issue death sentences, but they can participate in capital cases on appeal for reasons I'll discuss later. And yet another view, Justice Scalia also said that if he agreed with the position of Judge Barrett that the death penalty is morally wrong, then it would be wrong to participate in capital cases at any stage, trial or appellate, and that he would in fact have to resign from the Supreme Court. So a whole gamut of opinions. So I'll begin with some background on how the church's teaching on capital punishment has developed over time. Then I'll consider the view that Judge Barrett has held that the death penalty is immoral and what consequences would follow from that. And then lastly, I'll consider the view that the death penalty is, in fact, morally permissible under Catholic teaching. So start with the background. Pretty much everyone agrees that the death penalty has to be permitted to some extent under church teaching, because historically, the church has treated the practice as legitimate under some circumstances, and many Catholic countries have, over the centuries, had and applied the death penalty. This is an important point to make because the church is not like a legislature that can repeal older policies and adopt new ones, or even like a court that might treat precedents as presumptively right, but have the power to overturn even well-established precedents. Rather, Catholics believe that the church preserves and expounds upon and applies the faith that Christ handed down to the apostles and that has been faithfully preserved in each generation of the church. The church cannot go back on what it has definitively taught in prior generations, and the church doesn't claim to receive new revelations that abrogate older ones. At the same time, it's also important to note that from the very earliest days of the church, there have been voices who have said that the death penalty is contrary to Jesus' example and to the idea of Christian mercy, and who have said therefore that the death penalty shouldn't be carried out. So, you know, one famous example, St. Augustine, who lived in the 4th and 5th centuries, when he was a bishop, he frequently wrote to public officials urging them not to carry out scheduled executions. Still, if you were to take a time machine, say, to as recently as 1950, and ask people what was the church's teaching on the death penalty, you would find some Catholics who opposed the practice and some who favored it. But you'd be hard-pressed to find somebody who said Catholic teaching outright forbids states from executing criminals who've committed grave crimes. In the latter half of the 20th century, however, the strand of the tradition represented by St. Augustine of calling for an end to capital punishment started to become the dominant one. So as early as 1974, the bishops of the United States formally voted to call for the abolition of capital punishment in America, and they have continued to do that and issue statements over the years. They've done so making two main lines of argument in support of their position. One is based on circumstances, that the death penalty today is not even though it may have been in the past, is not today necessary to maintain public order, because our society has the rule of law and effective prisons that allow us to punish and incapacitate violent criminals without having to kill them. The other main argument they make is a dignity-based argument, that all human beings are made in the image of God, that they retain that dignity throughout their lives, no matter what wrongs they've done. And so just as the church stands up for the unborn, stands up for the mentally handicapped, stands up for those at the end of their life, so too it should stand up for those who've committed even serious crimes and call upon us to respect their dignity by sparing their lives. And over time, eventually, this view came to be expressed at the highest levels in the church. So, for instance, Pope St. John Paul II in 1995, in a document called Evangelium Vitae, said that capital punishment should only be resorted to in cases of absolute necessity. In other words, when it would not be possible otherwise to defend society. And he concluded that because today there have been steady improvements in the organization of the penal system, such cases are very rare, if not practically non-existent. And Pope Francis has gone even further. Most recently, just earlier this month, in a document called Fratelli Tutti, where he said that the death penalty is inadequate from a moral standpoint and no longer necessary from that of penal justice. Thus, he said that the death penalty is, quote, inadmissible, and that the church is firmly committed to calling for its abolition worldwide. And he has, in fact, called upon all Christians and all people of goodwill to work for the abolition of the death penalty. So that's sort of the background. And the question is how to interpret this development. So I'll start again with the view that Judge Barrett has, that this means that, you know, in a society like the United States today, the death penalty is morally wrong. It's morally wrong to execute criminals. On Judge Barrett's view, the church never had a clear position on capital punishment before the second half of the 20th century. You had kind of conflicting opinions going different ways, but not one definitively expressed teaching of the church. But as abortion and euthanasia and other attacks on innocent life became more widespread, the church has had to stand up and clearly and forcibly defend the dignity of all human life from conception until death. And sort of in the context of defending the dignity of all human life and articulating this pro-life position, the moral status of the death penalty became clearer. It became clear that God alone is the Lord of life and that no human good can justify the immoral act of deliberately taking a human life. And so, on Judge Barrett's view, as she said in an article, only reasons analogous to self-defense can justify capital punishment. So what does that mean? Well, under Catholic teaching, an individual person can kill in self-defense only when that is the only possible way to stop an assailant. In that case, your intention is not to kill, is not to end the person's life, but your primary intention is just to stop the assailant, and that their death is sort of an unfortunate secondary effect of stopping the attack. If there were any way to stop them without killing them, that would be morally required. And so the same thing with the death penalty. The only time you can have the death penalty is when it's literally the only way to stop someone from committing further crimes, from posing a further threat to society. And so when is that the case in the United States today with our prisons and rule of law? Pretty much never. And so that answers the question of what Judge Barrett would think about the death penalty, whether it's right or wrong. But we have to be careful and not jump the gun on the question of what that means for what a judge should do. And this is where I think the media and people in politics have misinterpreted her position. People have jumped from this conclusion to saying that she would either strike down the death penalty as unconstitutional or that she wouldn't be able to participate in capital cases as an appellate judge. If there is one thing that you get away from this talk, it is that if anybody tells you either of those things, that person has absolutely no idea what they're talking about. In response to the first point, Judge Barrett is an originalist and a textualist. And so, you know, in a capital case, she would determine whether the death penalty is permitted by the original meaning of the Constitution or the relevant statutes. On the second point, as we'll see, her view is only that a judge cannot directly issue a capital sentence. She does believe that an appellate judge can affirm a death sentence. In fact, she did work on capital cases as a Supreme Court clerk. She's affirmed capital sentences on the Seventh Circuit, and she's testified under oath before the Senate that she would be able to fully participate. So let's dive into that distinction. Judge Barrett's view turns on a distinction that the church makes between what's called formal cooperation with evil and material cooperation with evil. Cooperation with evil is a term in Catholic moral theology that means giving physical or moral assistance to a wrongdoer in a wrong act. Formal cooperation with evil is when you assist someone in carrying out an immoral action while sharing their immoral intention. And this is always wrong. So imagine a tenant in Nazi Germany who has a Jewish neighbor. The tenant wants to be able to take his neighbor's property, so he informs the Gestapo his neighbor is Jewish, and they take him away to a concentration camp. Now, even though the tenant in that case didn't himself haul off his neighbor, that was his intention for that to happen. And so he formally cooperated with evil and committed a grave wrong. Material cooperation is when you assist someone in carrying out an immoral action without sharing their immoral intention. And for this, there's no straightforward black and white material cooperation is always right or always wrong. Rather, as Judge Barrett put it, whether material cooperation is permissible depends on a kind of balancing test. You have to balance the good of the action that you're doing against the badness of the evil, the proximity between your action and the evil, and how certain it is the evil will come from your action. So for instance, say you want to be a mailman. You can know ex ante that a certain proportion of the mail you deliver will contain blackmail or threats or scams or obscenity. But you don't know which one. It's not your intention to do that. And you can say, well, even though some small proportion of the mail I deliver is being used for these bad ends, on the whole, it's a good thing to be able to deliver mail. Most mail is delivered for a good purpose. And so it's worth it for me to be a mailman, even though certain bad consequences will result. So applying this distinction to what a judge does, a sentencing judge directly orders the execution of the criminal in a capital case. So if the death penalty is in fact an unjust killing, that would be formal cooperation with evil. And even though the human law would command the judge to do it, the higher moral law would forbid it. And so the judge would have to recuse herself. But when an appellate judge affirms a capital conviction or sentence, the appellate judge does, in a sense, make it possible for the sentence to be carried out. But the appellate judge does not himself order the defendant's death. Instead, he considers only whether the trial court legally erred in issuing the conviction or sentence. And in the federal appellate context, typically the kind of questions are pretty remote from the question of does the petitioner deserve to die. It's often sort of neutral procedural rules that apply across the board in criminal cases, like a Miranda claim or a Strickland claim. But even in areas of law that are more specific to the death penalty, like say the Eighth Amendment, there you could say that it's worthwhile for the judge to ensure that there's a proper division of decision-making authority, that it's up to the people and Congress and the jury and the district court to determine whether the sentence should be issued and to decide these kinds of moral questions, and that it's not the appellate judge's role to intervene. And so on these kinds of this kind of reasoning, Judge Barrett concluded that the kind of material cooperation that an appellate judge does is a permissible kind of cooperation, even though it does lead to the unjust killing of the death penalty. Now, this isn't the only take on cooperation. As I said before, Justice Scalia said that if he believed the death penalty were immoral, he and all other Catholic judges would in fact have to resign. He actually does agree with Judge Barrett that the judge would be only material at cooperating, but he questioned whether the good of participation truly outweighed the evil. The way he framed it as, the material cooperation would only be justified if it were essential for the preservation of society that I, the appellate judge, me, Antonin Scalia, or me, Amy Barrett, it's essential for the preservation of society to be a Supreme Court justice or an appellate judge, when there are others who are perfectly capable of doing the job. And a basic sense of humility says, no, I'm not so important. Someone else can do it who doesn't have this conviction. And, you know, I do think there's something to be said for this view, especially because, you know, you also have to factor in the issue of scandal. You know, most people don't appreciate the fine distinctions between an appellate judge's role and a trial judge's role. And so if they see someone on the Supreme Court, you know, who professes to be a devout Catholic, affirming, enabling immoral executions to go forward, then it sends the message that the Catholic Church and Catholics generally are okay with this sort of thing. That being said, I think there is while Judge Barrett wrote before Justice Scalia and didn't have a chance to directly respond to him, I think we can imagine a pretty decent response that she could have made, which is that he's looking at it the wrong way. If you really believe the death penalty is immoral, and it's not just wrong for me specifically to participate, it's wrong for anyone to participate in the death penalty. And so then the question isn't whether it's essential for me, Antonin Scalia, or me, Amy Barrett, to do it. It's the question is whether it's essential for someone to do the job. And that answer clearly seems to be yes. You know, if you go back to the mailman example, the question isn't whether I specifically need to be a mailman, but whether someone it's good for someone to be a mailman. It's also worth pointing out that Scalia's view is, well, dictum. You know, he believed that the death penalty was right and he had no moral compunctions. And so he never actually had to put his money where his mouth is, so to speak, on the issue. So much for the view that the death penalty is morally wrong. What exactly is the view then that the death penalty is morally permissible that Justice Scalia held? This view holds that people who hold Judge Barrett's position are too quick to conclude that Church teaching before John Paul II was ambiguous. And this view holds that the Church did, in fact, speak with a unified, authoritative voice on the morality of capital punishment, provided that we make a key distinction between two questions. These questions are, one, does the state have the right to punish grave crimes with death? Is it right or wrong? And then two, to what extent should the state exercise that right under the circumstances? That is, even if it's morally acceptable, is it a good idea? So under this view of the death penalty, although there has been a diversity of views on the second question, is it prudent to carry out the death penalty? The Church has consistently taught that the state has the right to punish grave crimes with death. And for the Catholic judge determining whether he can, in good conscience, participate in capital cases, the only question that matters is the first one, whether the state has the right. Now, to understand this view, we need to step back for a minute and take a look at what the purposes of punishment are generally under Catholic teaching. The primary purpose of punishment is, under Catholic teaching, is retribution, to redress the disorder caused by the offense by imposing a penalty that is proportionate to the wrong committed by the offender, to give the offender, in other words, to give the offender a penalty that is on the same sort of level as the wrong he committed. Now, the secondary purpose, but that's not the only purpose. There are other secondary purposes, which include maintaining public order, maintaining public safety, promoting rehabilitation of the offender, deterring other offenders, and so on. Now, when we distinguish and we say that retribution is the primary purpose, what we mean by that is that it is an essential element of every just punishment. It's what makes the punishment just or unjust, moral or immoral. So if we don't have proportionality, if we don't have proper retribution, then we can't say that the punishment is just, no matter what the secondary purposes say. So for instance, if we said that we should have the death penalty for shoplifting, that might really effectively promote deterrence. People won't shoplift, and it might promote respect for, theft laws. But it's unjust because it's excessive. The shoplifter doesn't deserve to be killed. At the same time, the Church has never taught that the state has to fully exact retribution for every wrong committed. You know, and if the state tried to do that, we would live in a police state and society would fall apart. I mean, imagine you were fined every time you were rude to a coworker or didn't call your mother when you should. Instead, the prudent, this you have to take into when considering the prudential question of whether to punish a particular wrong and to what extent to punish that wrong, you have to take into account the secondary purposes. That said, the critical point is this. Even if all the secondary purposes militate towards a more lenient punishment, that is, if it's prudent to deal with a more lenient punishment, if retribution is still satisfied, then the punishment is not unjust in the way that executing shoplifters would be unjust. It might be a bad idea, but the wrongdoer still deserves the punishment he receives. Now, when we apply these ideas to Judge Barrett's understanding of capital punishment, we clearly see retribution is not a sufficient reason to inflict capital punishment. In the rare instances where Judge Barrett would say that capital punishment is morally permissible, it's not really permissible as a punishment, but as self-defense. Again, when you kill in self-defense, we're not saying the assailant deserves to die and you're giving them what you deserve, that they deserve. What you're saying is that you're just trying to stop them. And it's an unfortunate secondary consequence that the assailant dies. But on this rationale, the rationale that Justice Scalia embraces, retribution is sufficient. There are some crimes so grave that death is a just and proportionate response. But how can that be? How can that make sense, right? How can it be okay for the state to kill people if Christians are not supposed to seek revenge, if they're supposed to turn the other cheek? And the answer to that, the answer that Justice Scalia gives, is that what is moral for an individual to do and what is moral for the state to do are two different things. And historically, the church has grounded that distinction in St. Paul's letter to the Romans in the New Testament. So St. Paul says, you know, following Jesus, do not repay anyone evil for evil, because vengeance belongs to God alone, not to us as individuals. But when speaking of civil authorities, he says something different. He says that civil authority bears not the sword in vain. Instead, it is the servant of God to inflict wrath on the evildoer. That is, when the state performs a punishment or executes a criminal, it's not exacting personal revenge. It is acting as God's agent and is therefore executing God's justice. So if we were to return to St. Augustine, who, as you may recall, I said earlier, wrote to civil officials saying, please don't carry out executions, acknowledged on this basis, on the basis of the distinction St. Paul makes, that officials who participated in executions don't violate the command, thou shalt not kill. In his view, it's not the individual official who executes the criminal, but the law. And the individual is just a sword in the hand of the law. And precisely because we know St. Augustine opposed executions, we can conclude that he's not limiting his view that it's permissible to participate in executions to cases of absolute necessity. He's saying that the authority to carry out executions is above and beyond the authority of what a mere individual can do. And St. Augustine's attitude is representative of the church's thinking across the centuries. We don't have time in this call to do a 2,000-year survey of Catholic doctrine, but just to throw some names out there, you know, Pope Innocent I in the 5th century, Pope Innocent III and St. Thomas Aquinas in the 13th century, Pope Pius V in the 16th century, all expressed similar sort of sentiments. And in fact, as recently as 1952, Pope Pius XII said that the death penalty does not violate the right to life. And he made this argument not on a self-defense rationale. He said that the death penalty should be on the table for the gravest crime, and that it doesn't deprive the person of his right to life. It only deprives the condemned person of his enjoyment of his life after, by his crime, he himself has already surrendered his right to life. Okay, but how do you square that with the more recent teaching, the teaching of Pope John Paul II, teaching of Pope Francis, calling for the abolition of the death penalty? Well, one answer, and the answer that Justice Scalia himself gave, is you don't. Justice Scalia wrote, you know, John Paul II's teaching is not infallible, so I just have to give it my respectful consideration. And in characteristic fashion, he said, I respectfully considered it, and I disagree. I don't think that you necessarily have to go down that road to sort of adhere to the view that capital punishment is not immoral under church teaching. I think you can understand what Pope John Paul II, Pope Francis, and American bishops over the past 40 years as talking about the prudential judgment, about when should the state exercise its right to inflict capital punishment, not as denying that the state has the right to inflict capital punishment in the first place. In other words, they're making arguments from within the tradition of, you know, these are the purposes of punishment and how you should apply them, not altering the tradition, which has historically said that some crimes are so grave that death is a proportionate response. So, for instance, if we look more closely at what John Paul II said in his Evangelium Vitae, when he said that death penalty should only be imposed when absolutely necessary, he still characterizes the death penalty as a punishment. And he lists the traditional purposes of punishment, including retribution as the primary purpose. And he says that the death penalty can fulfill these purposes. Now, when he says that these purposes are fulfilled only when it's absolutely necessary for society, I think that has to be understood primarily as talking about the secondary purposes of punishment, about rehabilitation, about public order, because the moral blameworthiness, the question of how much punishment does the wrongdoer deserve, turns on the blameworthiness of his past action. It doesn't turn on how good the prison system is. And so in that sense, you can even view John Paul II as implicitly reaffirming the view that some crimes are so grave that death is a proportionate response. Likewise, Pope Francis in Fratelli Tutti reaffirms that the state can and must inflict punishments according to the seriousness of the crimes committed. He identifies his position with St. John Paul II. And he states, when he criticizes death penalty, he says that it's no longer necessary from the standpoint of penal justice. You know, Pope Francis, I think often he wants to focus on the concrete application of what should be done in the here and now rather than abstract questions. But his emphasis on that it's no longer necessary is showing that he's not trying to depart from the traditional view that some crimes merit death. He's saying that when you consider the circumstances, the right thing to do is to no longer exercise this right. So on this view that I've just outlined, does that mean that you can just brush aside what Pope John Paul II and Pope Francis have said? No. Absolutely not. Their statements don't meet the very specific criteria for infallibility, so it is possible to legitimately and respectfully disagree. But absent very good reasons for doing so, Catholics do owe assent to the firmly expressed non-infallible teachings of the Church. And in my personal opinion, I think that is what we have here. But critically, that teaching addresses only whether the state should exercise its right to execute criminals today. That teaching addresses only the prudential question, right? And so that matters a lot for people whose job it is to make the prudential judgment: prosecutors, legislators, voters, people whose job it is to decide, is it a good idea to execute criminals? But judges are different. It's not the judge's role to determine whether it's a good idea to carry out capital punishment. Rather, in some circumstances, the law requires judges either to issue or to affirm capital sentences. So the question is the law's command unjust such that I cannot in good conscience follow it? And because the state has the right to punish grave crimes with death, it can't be unjust to issue or affirm death sentences, even if, in the judge's view, as a faithful Catholic, he believes the death penalty should be abolished. And so in this respect, on this view that I've outlined, I think the question of a Catholic judge in capital cases isn't fundamentally different from enforcing a mandatory minimum that the judge thinks is too high. It might be a more extreme version, but it's a difference of degree, not kind. You know, just because you think this punishment is too harsh, it would be better public policy to get rid of it, it doesn't follow that it is unjust to the point that it would be immoral for me as a judge to carry out the law's judgment. And so now, just to briefly wrap up before taking questions, I think both views have their merits and their problems. I think one benefit of Judge Barrett's view is that it's just sort of an unqualified endorsement of recent statements. You don't have to add an asterisk. You don't have to add a qualification. And some of the statements about human dignity sort of looked at on their own really pack a very powerful punch that this is just not – the death penalty is just not the way we should respect human dignity today. On the view of Justice Scalia and others who say that the death penalty isn't wrong, I think that has the advantage of being better able to harmonize earlier teaching with more recent teaching. You don't have to say that it took the Church 19 and a half centuries to determine what the truth about capital punishment is or that it reversed its teaching. But both views, despite their differences, allow a wide space between what the judge supports as policy and what laws he can enforce in good conscience. And so I think regardless of which view, you know, we might ultimately find more persuasive, I think we can say that it's simply unwarranted to say that Catholic judges aren't fit on account of their conscience and their faith to participate in the judicial system. And with that, I'm happy to open it up to questions.
Great. Thanks very much, Ryan. So we'll go to the first one now.
Hello, my name is John. And I first want to say that I think you've done a phenomenal job of addressing the issue from many angles. I do, however, think that there's a number of things that are often neglected when considering this and addressing the role of Catholic teaching. And so maybe you can address them here. One is that it's the Catholic teaching on the death penalty really stems from the Bible. You know, in Genesis, it's a covenant with Noah, mm-hmm. wherein he actually says, you know, who spills man's blood his blood shall be spilled. The other, I think, too, that's important, I'll just limit this to three, is that while we may have the ability to incapacitate a criminal force, so that they don't harm society, I think we often forget what that does to the prison population, and that, you know, no one wants to go and live in a prison full of MS-13 members, right? I mean, there's other prisoners we have to consider. And there's also the idea that that living in those conditions or living in solitary confinement is actually not dignified. So in terms of preserving the dignity of the human person, that may not be necessary. And then the final thing is that there actually is a great bit of controversy surrounding the current pontificate, and particularly its legitimacy. And so I don't think that Scalia's view is really dismissive in the sense that some people think it is. I really think that we're going to see as time goes on. I mean, we just recently saw his pronouncement in this upcoming documentary in the papacy pronouncing certain things with respect to civil unions, which completely contradict, 2,000 years of church teaching as well. So I guess, so the three things are the Bible, the dignity of the fellow prisoners, and then finally the controversy surrounding the papacy. Thank you.
So, I mean, just to say that the fact that the church officials have sort of converged on one reading of how to weigh the prudential factors of capital punishment doesn't mean that there aren't other possible ways of doing it, or there haven't been other ways of doing it. So in fact, you know, there have been voices within the church who have more strongly emphasized that capital punishment is a way of vindicating the human dignity of the victim. And that in fact, even capital punishment can promote rehabilitation in the highest form by helping the wrongdoer confront the magnitude of his offense and thereby repent of what he's done. When I talk about prudential application of recent popes, and it's not just Pope Francis, it's John Paul II, it's Benedict XVI, it's Francis, and it's over 40 years of Catholic bishops, it is a difficult question exactly to what extent these kinds of prudential judgments are binding on conscience. I do personally believe that the magnitude, the force with which they've been expressed, the formality with which they've been expressed, is this makes it the sort of teaching that is at least presumptively the one that Catholics owe their assent to. That being said, these kinds of prudential judgments aren't infallible, and it is possible as a faithful Catholic to respectfully disagree and have a contrary view as long as one remains respectful of the view that church authorities have articulated.
Thank you. Okay, especially with regard to the fellow prisoners. I think that's an important point. Thank you.
All righty. We'll go to our next question now. Caller with area code 310. Go ahead with your question.
Hi, my name is Walter Partis. I'm calling from Los Angeles. And I want to ask you two things, but first I want to clarify. So you were saying at first that this is something that is allowable because the Catholic Church's doctrine has changed over time, and in times in the past, the death penalty was permissible. Is that basically correct, or what have I mischaracterized?
Well, I would say that the view is and has always been that the death penalty is a just and proportionate punishment for grave offenses. So when the death penalty is carried out today, I don't think it's unjust in the sense that, the criminal is not getting the punishment he deserves. That being said, the view of the Pope and of our bishops has been that in the context of today, it would be a better approach to not go so far as to carry out executions.
Actually, the current Vatican said the death penalty is wrong in all cases, 100%, even self-defense, it's wrong. So the current Pope in the Vatican has said it's 100% wrong.
I think it's important to distinguish the kinds of statements that various church leaders have made. So I will.
The Pope himself has stated this, though.
But the Catholic view is not, whatever comes out of the Pope's mouth is the judgment of the church. You have to look at the formality of the statement. Well,
I know.
Sorry, you're going to have to disagree.
I'm sorry for interrupting.
I think if you look closely at Fratelli Tutti, he identifies his position with John Paul II's, which clearly affirmed the legitimacy of the death penalty in principle. And, when the Catholic Church condemns something like abortion or euthanasia, it says that it calls abortion an unspeakable crime. Whereas Pope Francis in Fratelli Tutti says the death penalty is no longer necessary. Now, we would never say abortion or euthanasia are no longer necessary because they're wrong. I do think there is room for faithful Catholics to respectfully and legitimately disagree with Pope Francis's prudential judgment. But I do think that, it goes too far to say that he has said that the death penalty, in a formal way, that the death penalty is 100% immoral.
Here's my bigger point, though.
Can I finish? I would ask you to keep it to a question, please.
Okay, well, this is my real question. The Catholic Church throughout time has said that slavery is acceptable. St. Augustine said slavery is acceptable. For most of the Catholic Church's history, slavery has been acceptable. So under what you've said, if a nation state practices slavery and human trafficking, it would be fine.
I don't agree with that. That's a bit out of my area of expertise. Some people like to play gotcha about certain doctrines about slavery, about usury, about other areas where, the way the church talks looks different. There are plenty of faithful Catholic scholars who have maintained the position that the church's teaching is not one of a total reversal. As a Catholic, that's what you have to believe. Now, you might think that it's unpersuasive. I can't argue with you the merits of the slavery issue in this context. I don't have the relevant expertise. But, if you are a Catholic who's interested in abiding by the teaching of the church, then you have to believe that what the church has definitively taught is something that cannot be reversed.
Okay, we'll move on to our next question now, and I'll ask callers to please make sure that you're asking a question. We do have more callers in the queue. In an effort to get to all of them in time, I'll please ask you to keep it as short as you can, too. Thank you.
Hello there. Thanks a lot. Really great talk. Really appreciate it. Just had a question about the distinction between formal cooperation and material cooperation in the context of the trial judge versus the appellate judge. I'm having difficulty seeing why both judges wouldn't fall within the material cooperation category based on what they're doing. It seems that even when a judge is issuing, a death sentence or an order of execution, he might still fall into the material cooperation category if he himself is not intending that the person die. So suppose a judge is just intending, that he follow his duties as a judge or follow the law. but secretly hoping that, you know, the Supreme Court might issue a last minute stay or that the death penalty might be overturned. It seems like even a judge who's issuing a death sentence need not be formally cooperating with the infliction of death.
Yeah, that's a great question. And in fact, if you look at Judge Barrett's article, she does actually consider this objection that it might be sort of a clerical task and not really amount to formal cooperation. I would say that the reason why I find it persuasive that it would be formal cooperation, again, under the assumption that the death penalty is wrong, is that your intent, at least in calicmodology, is more than just the thoughts you subjectively think in your head. So if you fire a gun at someone, but you know you're reluctant about it, or you hope that you miss, if you hit them, it's still sort of, if you aimed at them and you hit them, it's still meaningfully your intent that you hit them. And another reason why, you know, even though the law doesn't give the judge discretion, it would count is that the death sentence is a kind of performative utterance. Before the district court judge issues the sentence, the executive has no power to carry out the sentence. But once the district court judge, and only the judge can do it under statutory law, unless there's a pardon, the executive then has the legal obligation. And so for that reason, I think it can be meaningfully said that the district court judge is willing the death of the criminal defendant.
Okay. Thank you.
Great. Thanks. We'll go to our next question now.
Hi. Thank you so much. That was a wonderful talk. I had a question about Scalia's position where he said that if he had agreed with now judge, hopefully soon to be Justice Barrett, that the death penalty was fundamentally wrong, he would have to resign. And I'm not entirely sure how that follows. So, for example, you know, my understanding is that, you know, Justice Scalia would have said that abortion is fundamentally wrong, and abortion is firmly ensconced in the law of the land right now. So if you can be a judge, Catholic or otherwise, who believes that abortion is a heinous moral wrong and yet participate in the legal system that legitimizes abortion, I don't understand why you couldn't be a judge that believes the death penalty is a heinous moral wrong and yet participate in a justice system that adds to that. And I guess sort of a just example of somebody who I think is kind of doing this is not from a Catholic perspective, but my understanding is that Judge Rakoff in the Southern District of New York has said for years that he thinks the death penalty is unconstitutional and just refuses to give death penalty sentences. And I mean, that perhaps wouldn't have been acceptable given Scalia's particular view of the role of the judge, but I'm not sure why that wouldn't be an acceptable compromise for most Catholics.
Sure. So I'll start with the Judge Rakoff point. I mean, basically, this, as I said at the beginning, this talk is premised on the assumption that American law does, in fact, require the death penalty. So, I mean, if you're a living constitutionalist who says the law is my moral predilections, then you know, you could do that. That being said, you know, most people in the judiciary, most Catholics in the judiciary, that is not their view of the law. So, you know, if you're of, you know, more of an originalist, textualist bent, then, you know, then the dilemma arises. Now, Justice Scalia in his article actually does directly address the issue of abortion. And what he, the distinction he makes is that, you know, with abortion and with many other evils that the law permits, when the judge issues a ruling that permits the evil to take place, he's not making it happen. It's the other person who's getting the abortion, having it be procured. But with the death penalty, the courts themselves are actually intimately involved. The court is ordering the killing. And so an analogy would be more, not a law that permits abortion, but a law, you know, that required the judge to order a woman to get an abortion would be something analogous.
Okay, great. We'll go to our next question now. And we've got a couple more in the queue left still.
Hi, this is Will Strench. I had a question about the recusal standards, you know, under the Judicial Code of Ethics, as opposed to the internal kind of recusal requirements of a judge's conscience. So do you think a district, let's say a district court judge who is having to kind of, you know, weigh the considerations and give the order, do you think that even if they thought, you know, in terms of this internal thing, it's not, you know, I'm okay making this decision, there could be an argument that because of these statements of the church and this conversation, certain person presents, the judge presents himself as a faithful Catholic, you know, they could trigger a party's motion, you know, that their impartiality might reasonably be questioned on this point. So I guess the question is, if we're in the realm of these kind of fine-grained distinctions, would we ever, do you think there's a good case for kind of that objective standard of recusal? Thanks.
Yeah. So, you know, I haven't studied the recusal statute deeply, and obviously this would vary federal to state. At the same time, I have a hard time thinking that if the judge takes the view that, you know, the capital punishment is acceptable in principle and that he can issue death sentences, even if he might disagree as a policy matter, I don't understand how a reasonable interpreter would say that his impartiality is in question, unless, you know, we assume that the reasonable interpreter would misunderstand their position, which I don't see as warranted, and, you know, would, you know, ultimately, you know, mean that there would be a serious question of recusal every time somebody has the view that says, as a matter of policy, I disagree with this law, but I'm willing to apply it faithfully. So I think that principle could, you know, if accepted, would lead to pretty sweeping and kind of absurd results.
Okay, thank you.
All righty, we'll go to our next question now.
Yeah, thanks very much. I guess a couple, well, really more requests than questions, perhaps, for those of us, in my case, Reformed Protestants who don't really know the details of canon law and so forth. I'm curious if maybe you could, you know, provide to the Federal Society for posting with the podcast associated with this, maybe at least a primer or an introduction to the appropriate sections of canon law. And I don't know, in terms of a source of ex cathedra statements, I've heard that Denzinger's Enchiridion is a reliable source, but I've also heard that's not a complete source for ex cathedra statements. Just curious about, you know, a good source for those resources, because your talk raises hopes that perhaps this might open up trial level positions for non-Catholic applicants if this is a significant problem for and there's also obviously potential forum shopping and gamesmanship for defense attorneys who are going to want to seek Catholic appellate judges or Catholic trial judges.
Sure. So, again, to be clear, I've tried to present both views, as fairly as I can. I, for what it's worth, sympathize more with the view that the death penalty is permissible in principle and that Catholics can participate in capital cases, even at the trial level. But, if you are interested in learning more about the authoritative sources of Catholic doctrine, Heinrich Denzinger's handbook does contain all of the a large number of the magisterial statements. It's a bit of a difficult read for a layman, though. If you want just a basic outline of what Catholic teaching is, I would recommend the Catechism of the Catholic Church.
Okay, we'll go to our next question now.
Yeah, sorry. Hi, my name is Rishabh Bhandari. I just want to commend you, Ryan, for, you know, a very learned talk. I really appreciate it. But I have one just broad conceptual question, and that's regarding jurors and whether it might be permissible to exclude jurors in death penalty cases.
I think that's a harder, a much harder question. I am less knowledgeable about the particulars of what the jurors are required to do. I now that I think about it more, I do think that if you take the Judge Barrett view, then you would have to that would preclude you from serving on a capital jury because recommending the sentence seems to me to be intending the death and would be formal cooperation. If you take the view that the death penalty is not wrong in principle, then it may be possible. It really depends on how much discretion you have in weighing the statutory aggravating and mitigating factors, and I'm not sure I can adequately answer that.
Okay, so we don't have any callers in the queue right now. We're coming up on the end of the hour. So Ryan, I'll give you a chance for any closing remarks you might want to offer.
Sure. Well, again, thank you again for hosting this. Yeah, again, I just to recap, I do think that both views afford a wide scope for Catholic judges to participate in capital cases. They are pretty much aligned on the issue of appellate proceedings. The question really just boils down to the trial judge and whether the trial judge can issue the sentence. And I also say, I mean, I heard, you know, some pushback of people who disagree with the kind of prudential judgments expressed by John Paul II in Francis and the bishops. And while, again, I do think it's the kind of teaching that people give their assent are required to give their assent to, at least presumptively, it is, in my opinion, possible to, in good faith, reach a different outcome if that's something that weighs on your conscience. But again, I would say that the big takeaway, I think, is that for Catholics, as for hopefully many other people, your view on the policy is really not determinative of whether you can in good conscience participate. And in fact, you can be a devout Catholic and participate in most, if not all, of capital sentencing procedures.
Thanks very much, Ryan. And thanks for being with us here today. On behalf of the Federalist Society, I want to thank you for your time and expertise. To our audience, thanks for dialing in. Thanks for your excellent questions. And as a reminder, we welcome your feedback. We welcome your feedback by email at info@fed-soc.org. And be keeping an eye on your emails and our website for announcements about upcoming telephone calls and about information and registration for the National Lawyers Convention, which will be a virtual week-long event in a few weeks. So thank you all for being with us here today. We are adjourned.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Teleform, a podcast of the Federalist Society's practice groups. For more information about the Federalist Society, the practice groups, and to become a Federalist Society member, please visit our website at fedsoc.org.